But Esther is where we are today. Esther is fascinating. You can take the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, and it's almost like we shouldn't probably separate them, although it's about three different individuals. But they could be, they're about the same, you know, kind of time frame. Successively, things happen in those time frames. Think of it in your mind if you think Bible timelines. I have a difficulty with that sometimes. This is 100 years after Daniel. Does that make sense? 100 years after Daniel. Now, what was significant about Daniel? Somebody said Daniel. Daniel was in Babylon. You remember Nebuchadnezzar and all that. The reason he was there was because of Israel's disobedience. That God said, look, if you're going to be disobedient, eventually somebody's going to come in and capture you and take you away. Well, that's exactly what happened. And so Daniel was in Babylon for 60 to 70 years of his life. And so this is 100 years after that. So this is way deep into Israel's history, getting closer to the time when Christ came. And so we start in, I better turn there myself, in Esther chapter 1. Another fun fact about Esther is that, maybe you know this, that the name or no name of God is mentioned at all in the book of Esther. Now, how many of you have read the book of Esther? I need to know that. Okay. How many of you, you don't know, people don't like answering this question because they feel ignorant. How many of you know? Okay, how many of you know the story of Esther? Okay, I'm hoping that somebody says they don't. Okay, somebody's brave enough. You can put your hands down. Somebody's brave enough to say, I don't know. I don't know. Okay, one, you're in for the ride of your life. Okay, I hope. The rest of you, try to erase from your mind the story, because sometimes it spoils the story. I know people that read the last chapter before they read the book, and I'm like, why would you do that? Why read the book at that point? You know how it ends. I like the unknown of what may be coming in the suspense. If you read this book and you don't know the end, you're like, this is bad news the whole time. And yet it centers around, and like I said, God is not mentioned, but you can't read this book without seeing God's hands in everything once you know that the end of the story. And so we're gonna talk about this as far as that's concerned in that kind of a way. We start in Esther chapter 1 and verse 1. Now, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even to Ethiopia. That's a long ways. Okay, and in those days, it was a really long ways. Most of the world. I mean, there wasn't a United States of America. Over 127 provinces, that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat in the throne of his kingdom, which is in Shushan the palace, in the third year of his reign, made he a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. So he is the king of the Medes and the Persians. Okay, these people are the ones that actually conquered the grandson or the son of Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, this is the end result of some of that. So that's where we are. And it says in verse 4, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 104 days. Well, how many days is that? 104 days. 180 days. So what would happen? What happened for 180 days? What happened? What was it? They basically had a huge party to show the glory and majesty and all his riches. That's a big deal. I'd get bored. I would. I'd be like, we got to do something else here. After like 3 days, I'm like, okay, stop the partying. I need to go, you know, pick my fruit out of my garden or something. You know, I need to do something else besides this. But that's what he did. He wanted to show that to the princes and to his servants. So rulers and his servants. But it goes on. Verse 5, and when these days were expired, 180 days, that the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan the palace, both great and small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. Sorry, you peasants out there that aren't servants of the king, you only get 7 days. But still, 7 days is a bigger party than I've ever been to. But that's what he does. He's like, hey, we're going to share the glory of the kingdom. Now, maybe because there were less princes and servants, and so, you know, he didn't have to buy as much pizza. When you buy it for everybody else, that's a lot of pizza. So, big party. Now, they talk about the decorations and things. And then, so, he's doing this, and he's got these nobles with him. And he says, you have never, if you've never seen my wife, it's, you know, I've shown you everything else around here, but you've got to see her. And so, he says, I want to call my wife in, Vashti. So, he calls his wife in, and she's like, I'm not going. I'm not doing that. Now, I don't know what their culture said back then about those kind of things, but she's like, I'm not doing this. I don't want to see your boys. I don't want to do that. And so he's like, what do we do about this? And so he's like, I'm embarrassed and I'm angry that she did this. And so he gets together with his counselors and he says, OK, guys, I'm not sure really what to do here. And they said, look, we've got to stamp this down, because if we let this go, then every woman in the kingdom is going to disobey their husbands. Now, I don't know if that's really what was going to happen, but so he said, OK, this is what we're going to do. Now, we're going to get rid of her. I don't know if they killed her. Some people believe that, or if they just banished her. Not really sure. But they took away from her all of the royalty that she had. She was no longer queen. And so some time expired, and the king said, look, I've got to replace the queen. And so he had the first a beauty pageant, maybe, that there would be, or whatever it would be. And he brings in all these girls from all over the kingdom, and he says, okay, I'm going to basically date each of you and decide which of you is going to be queen. Now, some of you might say, well, that would be really cool. And others would be like, that's not cool at all. But that's what he did. And I don't know if there was some kind of a precedent for that, but that's what they did. Now, one of these fair ladies' name was Esther. Can anybody tell me what her other name was besides Mr. Lawrence here? Yes, Ethan, right? Hadassah. Yes, I have met at least two girls named Hadassah. I actually like it just for that. And there's some really cool stories. Several years ago, Iran had a virus in their nuclear power facilities, and it created a lot of havoc. And nobody figured out, somebody does somewhere, but they were trying to figure out, was it America? Was it Israel? Who was it that did this? And they believed that it was Israel, because somewhere in the coding of this virus, the word Hadassah was written. And so I just find that really cool, and maybe you would too. But she was a special person. Now, we don't know her parents, because Mordecai is her cousin, but he's apparently one of those older cousins. Almost all of my cousins growing up, my dad was the youngest in his family, and it took him forever to get married. He was 38 before he got married. And then my mom, therefore, was also not super young when she got married, and she was the youngest in her family, which means all my cousins were adults when I was a young child. So the only cousins that I got to play with were like their kids. So it was like that situation. Some people say he was an uncle. Well, he acted like an uncle and he took care of her. Now, the uniqueness of this was, this is not Israel. These were children that were left from that captivity when Daniel and all the others were taken, and they're still in captivity. So she's almost like a servant living in this foreign country. Her parents are non-existent. They're dead, almost like an orphan. She's being taken care of. How she ends up here is pretty wild. But as we go through, we find out that everywhere she goes, it says, and you can see this in chapter 2 or 3, that she finds grace and kindness in the eyes of others because of her personality. And that reminds me that even a child is known by his doing. I don't know how old she was, but just by your actions, you are known. And it gave her grace with people, that people liked her because of her attitude. In fact, one of the things that these girls had was, there was a chamberlain, which is like a chief servant, somebody that would serve them. And he was told, look, whatever these girls want, you give it to them. Whatever it is. Now, I'm sure some of you would be like, ooh, you know, the king's basically like, here's a credit card, whatever you need. And you know what she said? She said, basically, no, whatever you've given me, that's fine. She was low maintenance. You know, that brought favor to her, because she wasn't demanding. She wasn't all those things, but it brought favor to her from them. As the story goes, Esther's cousin, Mordecai, notice verse 5. Now in Shushan the palace of chapter 2, verse 5. Now in Shushan the palace was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, with Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. As I already said, this is when Daniel was taken away. Verse 7. And he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took her for his own daughter. Now, it was his job, Mordecai's job, to sit in the king's gate. Now, that means he was some kind of an official. A lot of times in the gate, people would, instead of going to the king and saying, "Hey, king, you know, my neighbor and I, we have this dispute. The tree fell on my house, and I think he should pay for it. What, you know, and he doesn't want to pay for it. What do we do?" Well, instead of bringing that kind of stuff to the king, you would have somebody at the gate that would help make those decisions. And they would sit there and help to disperse that for the king. Well, one day, Mordecai is sitting there, and he overhears some guards talking. Now, I don't know, these guys weren't real smart, but they're plotting to kill the king, and he overhears them. And so he's like, "Okay, we gotta get to the bottom of this." And so he lets Esther know that. Esther tell them about this. And so sure enough, it gets up the chain, and they find out it is true. These guys are plotting to kill the king, but not much was done. Not much was done. It was written down, but that was it. End of story. But along the line, there's this other guy. Chapter 3, verse 1. "After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedah, the Agagite, and advanced him, promoted him, and set his seat above all the princes that were with him, and all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai, who also sat in the gate, bowed not, nor did reverence him. Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, 'Why transgressest thou the king's commandment?' Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him and hearkened, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman, to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew." So why wouldn't he bow? It was not just because he was a Jew, but being a Jew, he worships the God of heaven, which in those first two commandments, don't make images of other gods and don't bow down to anything besides Jehovah God. So basically he's saying, "I can't do that." Do you think maybe somewhere in his mind, he was thinking back about maybe 100, 150 years to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who in the same place with a different king refused to bow. And they said, "Oh, king, even if you're angry with us, even if you're going to make the furnace hotter, even if you're going to throw us in that furnace, we're still not going to bow down because our God is able and he will rescue us." Well, Haman is a bad guy. I mean, Haman is just about as promoted as he can be. And yet he is ticked off at Mordecai. And not only is he ticked off at Mordecai, but he then takes that anger and that hatred towards this one guy, Mordecai, and puts it over all the Jews, because he's like, "Okay, if it's this guy because he's a Jew, then I don't just hate him. I hate all the Jews." And so then he sets in his motion a way. How can I get this guy to bow down? You know, some people just want power. They're angry at people that won't give it to them. They're angry at people that might take it away from them. And they're willing to do anything to get that back. They're willing to do anything to get that vengeance. And so he sought to kill Mordecai and all those Jews. Now we move forward and we move into chapter 4. Now verse 1 of chapter 4. "When Mordecai perceived that all this was done, Mordecai tore his clothes. He rent his clothes and put on sackcloth with ashes and went out into the midst of the city and cried a loud and bitter cry. And it came even before the king's gate, for none might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth." So, in their way, in their culture, in order to really show your grief, you would put ashes on your head. Ashes are the remnants of something that's been burned. And oftentimes, you know, when a city was conquered, it would be burned. So it's been totally destroyed. And this represented some of that. And they'd wear sackcloth. And you're like, "What is sackcloth?" This gets kind of, I don't know, kind of gross. But today, you know, we have garbage cans. And in the garbage can, we put what? A garbage bag. And we even have today, we have these garbage bags that they're tear resistant. They've got strings at the top. When you pull them out, you know, you can tie the knot real easy. Back when I was growing up, we didn't have those little strings. We had to take the bag and tie it in a knot, you know. And even today, I found in my house, like, I put the bag in there one day. I was like, "What is that?" The bag is scented, you know. I mean, we have scented bags now so that it doesn't make trash smell better, okay? It's like a cover scent for hunting. You know, we just kind of cover it so you can't tell. But we have those things. They didn't have that back then. Surprise, they didn't have plastic, okay? And so what they did was they would have, great thought here, reusable trash bags. Sackcloth. That's what sackcloth is. And often, you know, that bag gets worn out. And so they would wear that. I don't know if they poke sleeve holes in it. I'm not sure what they did. But it was basically they were wearing trash bags. They were saying, "This is how I am." They can be, you know, very dramatic. And that's how I feel. I'm just torn up inside, and this is garbage. And so he couldn't go into the king's gate. Well, this embarrasses Esther. She's like, you know, people might know that we're related. You can't do this. You've got to. So she sends a messenger to him. She's like, "Hey, Mordecai, put your real clothes on. You know, you can get in trouble for this. You're supposed to be serving the king, and you're making all this grief." And Mordecai's like, "Look, this is bad times. You realize this guy is trying to kill us? He is trying to get this decree signed," and that's exactly what Haman had done. Haman had gone to the king, and he says, "Hey, king, we've got a problem. There's some rebels in your kingdom," because in his mind, that's what they were. And he's like, "We have to eradicate them. And look, king, I'll take care of all of it. You don't have to worry about any of it." And so the king said, "You know what? And I don't know. Sometimes these guys, I'm like, what were you thinking? Do you even pay attention?" You know, when Darius threw Daniel in the lion's den, he was like, "Oh, what have I done?" And I'm like, "What were you thinking? You just let these guys write the laws however you wanted?" Well, that's what they did here. He says, "Sure, write whatever you want. I'll give you as much money as you need to do it. Oh, here's my signet ring, and you can use that." And so the law is signed that all these Jews are going to die. And so Mordecai goes back to Esther. He says, "Esther, this is serious stuff. We just can't let this go." And that's where we really come to Esther chapter 4, verse 9. And Hatak came and told Esther the words of Mordecai, that, "Hey, this is serious stuff." And again, Esther spake unto Hatak and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. "And all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king, unto the inner court, who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death, except such to whom the Lord shall hold out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been called in to come to the king." And because Mordecai said, "Look, you've got to go to the king. That's what you've got to do. You've got to rescue us by going to the king. There is dire circumstances. All these Jewish people are going to die. You've got to do that." She said, "Look, the king's got a rule that nobody can come into the king. Nobody can talk to him unless he's called them in. Now, if they come in unasked for and he doesn't lower that scepter, then they're dead. This is serious." Now, I can't think of anything in our world that we would have that's like that. Other than, you know, you live close to D.C. If you jumped over that fence and ran towards the White House, bad things are going to happen. OK, and we laugh. But that, yeah, you're going to be in some pain at the very least. OK, and so she's saying, "This is like me jumping the White House fence and running at the White House. OK, I can't do that." And that makes total sense to us that we couldn't do that. But Mordecai goes on to say, in verse 12, "And they told Mordecai Esther's words, and Mordecai commanded to Esther, 'Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape the king's house more than all the Jews.'" What? Because you're a princess? Because you're the queen? You're going to survive? Because you're in the palace? You're not going to die? This writing had nothing to do with that. You're a Jew. You're going to die. For, verse 14, "For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then there shall enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place." What I like about that is Mordecai is saying, "Look, there are so many promises to God's people. God is going to do something. God may use it from may bring it from somewhere else. But Esther, you're the queen. Esther, don't think that this is some kind of coincidence that you just happen to be here." The rest of the verse says, "But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Maybe you've heard that phrase. And some people would say this is the key verse of the whole book. "For who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Now, again, remember, divorce your mind from everything that you know this book is going to be and bring it back to where it is. They are in terrible circumstances. This man has signed a law. He's made up the law that all the Jews, and I'm not sure why he did this, but on one day they can all be killed. All exterminated. Like, "Hey, we're going to fumigate the house today and get rid of these pests." That's the way he thought. Now, I have no doubt in my mind that this is satanically motivated. Satan has tried to do this many times to the Jews. I mean, they're probably the most persecuted people in all the world. But yet God has protected them. And here he is, Mordecai, saying, "Look, God's going to do this, but maybe God has put you here for this reason." Now, why do you say that? Why do I say that? Why is this relevant to us? Because, young people, we live in a world that is literally by the thousands pouring into hell. And God has put you in this world for that kind of deliverance. Don't think it's an accident that you live where you live, in the time frame that you live, with all the circumstances. And you can say, well, yeah, but you don't understand my family situation. Do you really remember her family situation? I mean, she's basically an orphan being raised by her cousin, and then she's, whether willingly or unwillingly, I don't know, taken out of that situation to be thrown into the palace. And yeah, it's posh. Yeah, it's cool. Yeah, there's a lot of perks to that. But maybe all of this is outside of her will. And yet God has placed her in her world, in her time, for a deliverance of people. And if you look at, go down the list of favorite Bible characters. Every single one of them God used to deliver other people. That's what God does. God uses people to deliver other people. Why are we here? Is it to deliver somebody from the oppression of whoever? No, it's to deliver people from their sins. Jesus came to seek and to save that which is lost. And he said, as the Father has sent me, even so send I you. Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. There's a reason that we're here. And it's not to live in the palace or to live in America or to live it up. Okay, it's not for that reason. It's for a deliverance. And he goes on, then Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer. Go gather all the Jews that are present in Shushan and fast for me. I'm going to need help. That didn't mean she wasn't scared. She's just like, I need people pray. And neither eat or drink 3 days, night or day. And I also, my maidens, will fast likewise. So will I go into the king, which is not according to the law. Okay, and this is what makes Esther like one of the best heroes in all the Bible. Okay, because she says this. And if I perish, I perish. I love that. And she's like, you know what? If I die, I die. I don't know if why I'm here is to go to the king. Maybe I'm wrong. But there is an obligation to my fellow human beings that are going to die maybe they will anyway. But I have to do my part. And young people, every single one of us needs to ask God, what is my part? I'm here. You have connections. Every single one of you has connections that nobody else in this room has. You have people that you talk to or that you're associated with, and they're not just always your age, that God has put you in contact with to show them who He is. And that doesn't mean that tomorrow you have to walk to their house or wherever they are that you know of and open your Bible and preach to them the whole Gospel of John. But when you are with them, can you reveal Christ to them in some way? Are you seeking in your heart and your mind and your prayer life that is there a time when I can share the Gospel with them? Because God has placed me in this world for deliverance. And I have to say, you know what? If I get embarrassed, I get embarrassed. If I fail, I fail. If I die, I die. But I am so will I go. But I'm going to do that. Now, as the rest of the book goes on, she goes into the king. The king says, okay, hey, great, sure. What do you want, Esther? And she says, I'd like to have a banquet with you. And one other person. And he said, well, who would that be? And he said, well, it's Haman. And so they have the banquet. Now, Haman, man, he's just like, I get to have a banquet with the king and the queen. I must be somebody special. And so they have this banquet. And the king says, okay, what is it? You want something. What is it that you want? She said, I tell you what, we'll have tomorrow night. We'll have another banquet. And let's just do that. And so he says, okay, you know, so Haman, he's going home and he's like, I got invited to this banquet. He said, I'm somebody special. And his head is like enormous, right? And he goes home and he's going to tell people, you know, hey, look, I've been promoted. I've been all this and I've been all that. But on his way home, guess what happens? He walks through the gate and there's Mordecai, and Mordecai doesn't bow. And just that ruins his life. I mean, he goes home and he's like down in the dumps, and then he comes back, and the king had a dream that, or not had a dream, he couldn't go to sleep. And so he's like, man, I can't go to sleep. He said, what should we do? He's like, yeah, I know, I'll read history. That'll put me to sleep. And so he says, bring in the Chronicles. And so they brought in the Chronicles, and he's reading these Chronicles. Now, if I'm going to read Chronicles, I'm probably going to be like, hey, let's read from way back in time, and I don't remember. But some, for some reason, he reads basically current time, and he reads about what Mordecai had done in saving his life. And he's like, wait a minute, how come I didn't know about this? And so he says, he goes to somebody and says, have we done anything to Mordecai for what he did? And no, we didn't do anything. And they're like, well, we've got to do something. So Haman comes in the next day and he's like, hey, Haman, what would you do if you wanted to really honor somebody? If you really wanted to make them feel special, if you were the king and you were going to do that? Well, you know, Haman's head is so big and he's so proud. He's like, this has got to be me. He's got to be talking about me. He's like, so what would I want done? And he's like, I tell you what, he said, I'd put on the royal apparel. I'd give him, you know, if I were the king, I'd let him wear my robe, and I'd get the royal horses out, and I'd have him take him on a parade through the city, just him, and I'd have somebody yell before him, this is what happens to the man that the king wants to honor. And he's like, man, this is going to be great. And so the king says, I tell you what, Haman, I want you to do that for Mordecai. I mean, the poetry in this, right? That this man who hates Mordecai, who's plotted to kill Mordecai, now has to, he's got to be the one in front of the horse saying, this is what happens to the man that the king wants to honor. How embarrassing for him. He goes home and he tells his family, and his family's like, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. And at one point, I kind of skipped it, but at one point they're like, hey, in order to get Mordecai, you need to build a gallows at your house. Now, who builds a gallows at their house, right? Somewhere where you can hang somebody. Who does that? Well, he did. And you know how high they built it? 50 cubits. So a cubit is how long? Somebody tell me. 18 inches. So I'll let you answer this. 50 cubits is how many feet? How many feet? Because we don't think in cubits. So that'd be 50 feet and 50 half feet. All right. So that would be 75. 75 feet high. This ceiling's maybe 30. Okay. How tall does anybody need a gallows? Right? I mean, like, you're hanging somebody. They don't need 75 feet unless you're trying to show them off to everybody else. Right? So that's what he did. He built a gallows. I don't know how quickly you do that, but he built a gallows at 75 feet high. And so night number two of the banquet comes along. So they're all in there, and so finally the king says, look, Esther, you got to tell me, what is it that you're trying to get? And she said, well, someone is plotting to kill me and my people, all of them. And it's going to happen. And he gets angry, as if he doesn't know what's going on. I'm like, king, you're the one that allowed this to happen. And he said, well, who is it? And she said, it's this wicked Haman. Now, if you're Haman, you got to feel like, is there somewhere I can leave here? The king was so angry. I mean, this guy's a little volatile. The king is so angry, he leaves the room. He's just so angry. Well, in the process of that, Haman is like, he's like begging her. You know, I don't know if she's sitting on a couch. I don't know what the deal was, but he's like laying on top of her like, please spare my life. And the king comes in, he's laying on top of her, and he's like, what are you doing now? What are you doing? You're abusing my wife? And so he has the guards take him immediately out of the room. And, you know, it's bad times for Haman all around. So then, how are we going to fix this? How are we going to fix this problem with all these Jews are supposed to be killed in this day? So here's what the king does. The king gets together with Mordecai and Esther, and they come up with this plan that because, why he did this, but because Haman put in that bill that he wrote that it had to happen on one day, that the king said, look, the Jews are allowed to defend themselves. Oh, and what's more is they're not just allowed to defend themselves. On that day, they can go in my kingdom and kill anybody who is their enemy. And so that's what happened. You know, at the end of the book, it says that over 75,000 people of the Jews' enemies were killed inside that foreign country. Today, the Jews in New York City still celebrate, and across the world, the Feast of Purim, which points all the way back to this. Because it was one of the greatest victories that Israel ever happened, because one young lady did what she was supposed to. You know, this tells us several things. Number one, that God is always working. If you read this, you think it's terrible things. But if you look back and think God's hands, you think, man, God did that. God was, he organized this. Even though it looked bad, God was using the bad for ultimate good. And we might look at things in our lives and say, this is terrible. This is ultimately bad. But have faith in God that God is using that. God is always at work, even though we can't see it. And God uses people, even the most unexpected people. And you might say, well, my life is, you know what? Her life was, Joseph's life was, Daniel's life was. I mean, you look at the things that happened to some of those people and you're like, this is bad. But you know what? God used them. God is looking for people to use in fantastic ways, despite her family. Some people speculate that there was some other failings in her life. So despite the failings, despite the fact that she was afraid, God still used her. And I find that even in my life, it doesn't, regardless of whether I'm afraid or not, that really doesn't affect anything unless I let the fear stop me from doing what God wants. But if I say, okay, I'm scared to death, but I'm still going to do this, you know what happens? God does things that I say, you know what, that's a miracle. That's amazing. God uses people. God is still working. But it also teaches me this, that I need to be like Esther, that I need to have confidence in God. You know what, I can't see it, but I'm going to trust God. If I perish, I perish. But I'm going to trust God, that God's going to provide some kind of deliverance. That I need to have courage in the face of adverse circumstances. And those adverse circumstances might be who I am, and maybe my lack of ability or my whatever, or my lack of resources or whatever. I might look at that and say, well, how? I need to have courage, and then I need to make commitments. She said, I will go. And if I die, I die. A commitment that, you know what, no matter what, I need to do what I have the availability to do. Some people say, well, I haven't been called. Where was she called? But she had an availability. She was in a place where, you know what, I can do something. Maybe I can't do everything, as somebody I know used to say, but I can do something. And if I can do something, then that I'll do that thing. And have a commitment that you're going to do what God has placed in front of you. With your heads bowed and eyes closed. And I know what your life looks like, and I don't know the possible negatives or crazy circumstances. And maybe you look at life and you're like, how is God in all of this that happens? And I don't know how long it took for Esther to see what was going on. And maybe all of it happened before she realized that. But we have to have that ultimate confidence that God is working and God wants to use us. But at the same time, we have to have that faith to say, Lord, I do trust you. And Lord, though I'm scared, I'm going to take these steps. I'm going to be that because I trust that you're always working and that you want to use me. But I need to commit to that. And maybe God has spoken to your heart in a special way today. Maybe there's some things that you've allowed in your life to blind you from those things. Or maybe there's some things that you've just not taken the steps that you know you need to. And you'd say, you know what, I need to be like Esther, and I need to make some commitment to obey God in the face of all this that's going on. Would you take these next few moments, and maybe you feel like it's comfortable for you to just to come and kneel at this altar and say, God, I give this to you, and Lord, I'm going to commit this to you. Maybe that's what's good for you. Maybe you need to just pray at your seat, but what you need to do is do business with God. As the hymn of invitation begins to play, you do the business that God has spoken to your heart about. Maybe you've lacked some faith that God is actually working right now. Maybe you need to talk with somebody. We've got some workers in the back. We've got some kids moving already. We've got some workers in the back. And you say, you know what? There's some things in my life that I need some help with.